Welcome to the next section of modern architecture. Make sure you're on slide one. We're going to take a look at Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Water. So this particular house is a weekend home belonging to the Kaufman family. Sometimes you'll hear the structure referred to as Kaufman House. And it's built in the middle of the Bear Run Nature Reserve in an area called Mill Run. And in this area, there's a stream that flows at about 1,300 feet above sea level, and then suddenly it breaks to a fall at 30 feet. And in this particular site, Frank Lloyd Wright designed a beautiful home that redefined the relationship between man, architecture, and nature. So we've looked at a lot of architecture in this course, but what we haven't talked about is how an architectural site truly unifies itself with nature in a harmonious way. And so when you think about falling water, one thing I want you guys to keep in mind is that this does have a relationship with nature. This particular architectural site was designed to be in keeping with nature and exist in a harmonious way with it. So more on that later. So as I mentioned, this house was a weekend home for the Kaufman family. And the Kaufman family owned this piece of property for 15 years. And originally, when they commissioned Wright to build this house, they envisioned something that would be a home that would look out at the waterfall. So imagine, like, you have a home, you have a window, you look out that window and you see this beautiful waterfall. But Frank Lloyd Wright instead decided to integrate the house design with the waterfall itself. And so he placed the home right above the waterfall, and he basically made it a part of their life in the house. Now, one big piece of inspiration was Japanese architecture. Wright had an admiration for Japanese architecture, and certain tenets of Japanese architecture were very important for inspiration of this house, along with most of his work. So just like in Japanese architecture, Wright wanted to create harmony between man and nature. And in Japanese architecture, it's a way to like maintain balance, and it's an important part of the human existence is finding your place within the world and also that balance between man and nature. And so by integrating the house with the waterfall, Wright was successfully able to create that balance and that relationship with man and nature. So go ahead and move on to slide two. A house that complements its natural surroundings. So the house was meant to complement its site while still competing with the drama of the waterfall and the endless sounds of crashing water. When you're actually in this home, you can hear the waterfalls. So the power of the waterfall is always felt, not necessarily visually when you're inside the house, but you can experience the waterfall anytime you're in the house by listening to its sound. The breaking water is constantly heard, no matter where you are within the house. Wright revolved the design of the house around the fireplace. The hearth of the home was an area of the house that he considered to be like the heart, the gathering place for the family. So at the waterfall, there's a rock that cuts into the fireplace, and it physically brings the waterfall into the house. So the rock wasn't placed there as part of the building. The rock was already part of the natural surroundings, and the house was built like around that. Wright also brings to notice this concept by dramatically extending the chimney upwards to make it the highest point of the interior of the house. Go ahead and move to slide three, the home. Falling Water consists of two parts. There's a main house that belonged to Kaufman, the clients, which was built between 1936 and 1938, and then a guest room which was completed a little later in 1939. The original house contains simple rooms furnished by Wright himself, with an open living room and compact kitchen on the first floor. There's three bedrooms on the second floor, and the third floor becomes a location of the study and the bedroom of Edgar Jr., the Kaufman's son. The rooms all relate towards the house's natural surroundings, and the living room even has steps that leads directly to the water below. The circulation through the house consists of a very narrow, dark passageway, And this was intentional in order to create this experience of compression. So when you experience this compression, and then when you move into the outdoors, you kind of get a sense of like opening up into nature. So creating that experience was intentional. The ceilings of some rooms are very low, in order to direct your eye horizontally to look outside. So you're not supposed to look up into the house. You're supposed to kind of look out when you can, out the windows into nature. The beauty of these spaces is found in their extension toward nature. And Wright achieved this by creating long cantilevered terraces that shoot out at a series of right angles. The terraces, which are visible kind of like horizontal structures, add an element of sculpture to the house, aside from their function. Go ahead and move to slide 5. The terraces, as you can see in the picture on slide 5, override with horizontal force. They protrude out from the architectural site, and they liberate the space by creating these rising parallels from the ground. In order to support them, Wright had to work closely with engineers, and the solution to make these huge horizontal terraces were to create a kind of an interesting system of materials. Now, typically, something like this could be supported by columns, but Frank Lloyd Wright was trying to create these very like independent protruding terraces. So he didn't want anything supporting them underneath. And so the house kind of takes on this masonry form. And the way he creates these terraces is he creates a reinforced concrete structure. So essentially there is like a steel frame within the concrete. So it creates a very sturdy, durable form. Now, over time, they've actually had to reinforce these terraces additionally. So if you're looking beneath, and I'll try to find a picture to add into the slide presentation, you can see cracks and areas where there's some tension within the architecture itself. So let's go ahead and move into slide 6. So we're going to be taking another look at the exterior. Okay, the exterior of Falling Water enforces a strong horizontal pattern with bricks and long terraces, the terraces that we just looked at. The windows on the facade also have a very special condition where they open up at the corners. So the windows are continuous. It's supposed to be like one long continuous window. And so the corners can actually be completely opened up without having any frame holding in the window. And Frank Lloyd Wright designed these windows. His overall goal was to break the box of the house and open up into the vast indoors. So once again, kind of reiterating some points from some previous slides, when you're inside the house, you're in these kind of compressed spaces so that when you move outdoors onto the terraces or you exit the house, you have this feeling of openness. You have ceilings that are intentionally low so that you look out the window and you kind of feel the sensation of like expanding into the outdoors once you enter that space. And these windows that open up at the corners also reinforce this idea as well. So the perfection of these details don't only change the experience that you have when you view the architectural site, it's also something that kind of influences like your personal experience as you interact with the space. So anytime we look at architecture, it's not just about how it looks. It's like imagine yourself in a space that's very closed off and then suddenly opens up. That definitely reinforces your experience and your relationship with nature while you're still also in the house. So these details that Frank Lloyd Wright integrated into the house did make some structural problems. Falling Water is now a National Historic Landmark, and it's considered an architectural work of genius. The daring cantilevers of those horizontal terraced areas, the corner window details, the constant sound of the waterfall that you experience when you're inside the house. Falling Water is a spiritual and physical occurrence of man and nature unified with harmony and nature. I mean, it's not just about how the building looks, it's about the overall experience. Go ahead and move to slide 7, which is our last slide about falling water. And we're going to talk a little bit more about organic architecture. So a lot of times we talk about Frank Lloyd Wright, we talk about organic architecture, meaning that architecture that takes its cues from nature more so than architecture that takes its cues from a logical, structured, mathematical system. When you look at the horizontal cantilevers of the terraces, it's almost as if it kind of replicates the motion and the direction of the water. So Frank Lloyd Wright also had a transcendentalist background, and I think you would have studied the transcendentalists in Honors 10 or if you studied American literature. And the transcendentalists have a belief that human life is part of nature. There's a huge emphasis on experiences in nature and having a close link to nature. And this kind of reminds me, you know, a lot of the ideas we talked about with modern art, where the modern experience is powerful, it's industry, it's urban, it's innovative. But then there's also this part of human nature that you want to have this true, genuine connection to nature. And transcendentalists definitely looked for that connection. So Wright incorporated, you know, the rocks that were basically like native to that area. He didn't move rocks to make the architecture. He built the structure around existing rocks on that site. As I mentioned earlier, with that central hearth that was like the center of the home. And so there's kind of this delicate synthesis of nature and environment that really constitutes why Falling Water is such a well-loved site. The rocks, the cantilevered ledges, it's just something that makes it such a, not just a building, but it basically functions as part of the environment, part of the setting of this natural site. Wright further emphasizes this organic connection with nature by liberally using glass. The house basically has no walls facing other walls. There's stone columns, there's fireplaces, but there's no rooms that essentially are wall to wall. There's always a way that you can see into outside, into the exterior. And there's also certain parts that are kind of interesting, as the picture you see here. There's actually a tree that grows through a certain part of the house. And instead of removing the tree or changing the architecture, the architect actually created basically beams that are curved around certain trees and certain areas in the house. So really, this architectural site is intended to be something that coincides and unifies with this particular environment and this particular setting. Okay, you can go ahead and move to slide 8. We're going to look at another building, very different than the one that we just took a look at. It's the Seagram Building. So the Seagram Building is a skyscraper, and the important thing you need to know about the Seagram Building is essentially it is considered a work that really references classicism. The architect definitely took a look at reviving some important aspects from classical architecture within this particular site. So make sure you guys are on slide 8. Sorry, I forgot if I said that or not. So the Seagram Building was designed by an architect named Ludwig Mies van der Rohe. So when you talk about his last name, it's Mies van der Rohe. And this is a landmark for New York City, and it's also a landmark for 20th century modernist American architecture. And what makes this a landmark of architecture is that Mies van der Rohe was able to make a perfect marriage of sorts between classical and Gothic elements. It was commissioned by the owner of Seagram's Whiskey in order to be the new headquarters of the Canadian company in New York City. And so analysis of the building will often reference its classical architecture, for which Mies van der Rohe was definitely, I don't want to say a fan of, because that kind of cheapens the reference. He had a deep appreciation for classical architecture, and these elements are all incorporated into this building. And he uses industrial materials. But he also brings in this classical sensibility of proportion, logic, symmetry, and balance. And these are definitely terms that we can use to describe this particular tower. Okay, moving on a little bit more about the Seagram Building. Why don't you go ahead and move to slide 9. So, Mies van der Rohe believed that less is more and that God is in the details. And both of these tenets are evidence and seemingly sometimes in contradiction, because when you think of less is more, you imagine that details are taken away. So how can God be in the details? But it's really this like simple sensibility that lends itself well to this sleek, modern quality of this building. This building was considered a huge avant-garde statement when it was completed in 1958. And really, it's the materials that connect to this less is more and the God is in the details idea. So the building flaunts its glass and metal, as you can see in the image here. The first time I saw this particular detail, it kind of reminded me of those like wallpaper backgrounds that we see on computers, like on a lock screen or a home screen, where you appreciate the beauty of the detail that you're looking at, but sometimes you don't really know like the source material it comes from. But anyways, so he used glass and metal, and he forego the use of heavy stone and brick used in ornamental facades of previous decades. The Seagram Building helped usher in a new era of simple, straightforward skyscrapers, and a building that embraced and celebrated its structure and its minimalist geometries, rather than trying to cover them up with superfluous ornament or some overdone details. But the Seagram Building is not completed without its inconsistencies. While modernist ideals elevated the concept of functionality, you know, think back to Sullivan, form follows function. A lot of modernist buildings really emphasize their function. This building actually has a bronze exterior facade that features non-structural elements. And what I mean by non-structural is certain elements that you look at, but they don't support the building. If you take those elements away, the building can still stand. And so when you introduce elements that have nothing to do with the structure, they're not for function, they're for decoration. And so visually, they suggest they support the structure, but in fact, they're non-functional. The building's actual supports are hidden within the bronze and glass facade. And inside, the building has a luxurious use of bronze, travertine, and marble, which create an opulent, if sleekly minimalist, interior aesthetic. Now, you guys don't have any images for the 250 that require you to have an understanding of the interior, but based on the sleekness of the exterior, you can kind of imagine that that would be replicated within the interior. All right, so let's talk a little bit more about the classicism. Sorry, let me kind of get my notes back up. Analysis of the building, and you can move to slide 10, will often reference classical architecture. So Mies van der Rohe, as you know, has a deep appreciation for that. The tower itself does use industrialized materials, but it's the terms I kind of talked about earlier, proportion, logic, symmetry. Those were all things we talked about when we talked about the Parthenon. We talked about perfection, golden ratio, balance. And these are all tenets that Mies van der Rohe had in mind when he designed his architectural buildings. So the ground floor references temple pillars because of the rhythmic regularity of its columns and bays. There is a tripartite division of the tower, and there is this articulation between the base, the shaft, and the capital. The plan for this building is symmetrical and follows a grid structure. Bronze I-beams are used on the exterior facade to create vertically expressive striations. Simultaneously, I-beams have no structural purpose, but they pay reference to the main steel structure of the building. Although Mies van der Rohe wanted to articulate the internal steel structure, he was required to encase the steel structure in concrete due to fire regulations. Steel can melt if it's not encased properly. The luxurious finishes on the outside and the interior are also a reference to the opulence of antiquity. And at its time, when the Seagram Building was constructed, it was the most expensive tower created in New York City. The tower is also very famous for the way it's set back from the street. So go ahead and move to slide 11, and we're going to talk a little bit about how it's set back. Okay, being on slide 11, during the time that this structure was built, it was common to fill your entire plot of land for whatever structure you were building. Imagine being in like New York in a busy city, and you don't walk across a lawn to get to a building. You don't walk through a parking lot. The buildings are right next to the sidewalk. But the Seagram Building is set back about 30 meters. And so there's conflicting views as to why Mies van der Rohe justified this design intention. Remember, everything in architecture is intentional. So one belief is that he set back the building away from the sidewalk in order to respect another building that was across the street. However, others argue that by setting the building back, it actually allowed a passerby to have a unique architectural experience that you seldom find in an urban place like New York City. By having distance from the street, pedestrians are able to better view the powerful force and presence of the Seagram Building. Its setback also allowed for desired perspective for architectural photography. It's also argued that the plaza and reflection pools were not intended for extended occupation of the public because of its narrow size of the curbs and minimal design. And so sometimes the plaza out front will sometimes host like sculpture exhibits, which is something that also that setback design allows to happen. So of great importance is the connection from the street to the office tower. So when you walk up to the building, it's like kind of like walking up a procession. You walk from the street towards steps of the plaza across a vast open space, past the overhang and columns through a delicate curtain wall. And so this is almost like the experience of like walking up to a temple. When we studied the Parthenon, we looked at steps, you look at columns, you pass beneath the columns, and you go into the temple cella structure. You have that similar experience here. And knowing that Mies van der Rohe had a great appreciation and deep understanding of classical architecture, it would make sense that he tries to replicate that experience of entering the structure, just like you would with a classical temple. Okay, you can go ahead and move to slide 12. And we're going to talk about a postmodern architect, Robert Venturi. So Robert Venturi, you know, every time I talk about this site, I have to kind of like smile. This is definitely one of those artworks that people get mad at. And it's kind of funny, but people just don't like the way this structure looks. But remember, when we're talking about architectural sites and any artwork in the 250 or in the study of art history in general, it's not about if you like an artwork or it's beautiful. Like, you want to understand like why the artwork was made and what it's being used for, what its function. Now, this does have a domestic function. This is another vacation home. However, Robert Venturi has his own ideas of what architecture should be. So let's jump into that in slide 12. So Robert Venturi's Newcastle County House offers a modest but really instructive example of the postmodern style that he created in this area of North Delaware. Venturi was a very influential teacher and theorist, and he studied architecture at Princeton, and then he also studied in Rome during the mid-1950s. During that time, he developed an interest towards post-Renaissance architecture, particularly works built during the Mannerist and Baroque periods in Italy. Now, when you hear Mannerist and Baroque, what you should think about is Mannerism was all about style, not looking at things naturally, not necessarily following logic or achieving perfection, but really focused on style. And when you hear Baroque, you should think about drama and about tension. And when we looked at those two particular styles, it didn't have the clear, logical austerity that we saw in Renaissance artwork. It had a different interest. All right, so Robert Venturi published a book called Complexity and Contradiction in Architecture. And he wrote this while he was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania. And in this book, there's dozens of small black and white photographs of Western architecture from ancient times to present day, as well as some of the architect's early architectural works. And a little bit about this artwork, a little bit about his ideas. Let me switch up notes real quick. He really took issue with the way that the modern architecture movement always looked for simplified solutions. Now think back to the artworks we just looked at. The Seagram Building. It's simplified. It's a force. It's classical. It's balanced. Take another step back to Falling Water. Think about the outside of the building with those horizontal cantilevered terraces. There's like a simplicity and a balance to it. So what he does is he challenges this rigid, formalist, reductionist strategies that some of these modern architects are using. And he believed that buildings, like the people who occupied them, are just not that simple. He took delight in breaking those rules. And he liked the idea that, you know, decoration should be a big part of architecture. And so when we look at his architectural sites, there's definitely a lot of decoration, and you will definitely see a lot of decoration in the house at, sorry, I always get this title wrong. I have to like read it to say it correctly. House in Newcastle County in Delaware. Okay, so a little bit more about his views. Venturi was also really interested in creating a facade that almost functioned like a billboard. And so his facades of his houses, and I kind of say this with hesitation, they don't really have a function. It's basically just something that serves as like a veneer and gives you some kind of impression of what the house is going to be like inside. Instead of giving order and simplicity that modernists really like, Venturi chose to like be surprising and jar people and provide a lot of contradictions. And we'll definitely see this with his artworks. Okay, now you can move to slide 13, and I'm going to read just a short snippet about what Robert Venturi says about this house that he designed. And what I'd like you to do as I read this part is just look at views of the house so that you can kind of connect these ideas to something visual. So he says that the house is built for a family of three, and it has an unusual program. The wife is a musician, a performer who required a music room containing an organ, two pianos, and a harpsichord. This room should be appropriate for small gatherings. Another interest of the family is birdwatching, so that big windows facing the woods are important. The husband also needs a study in a remote part of the house. The house sits in rolling fields at the edge of a valley towards the west with woods towards the north. Traditional in northern Delaware, where the site is located, are 18th century classical barns with generous scale and low horizontal proportions. The walls of these barns are fieldstone with areas of wood frame and siding in the upper sections. We based the form of the house and its symbolism on this kind of indigenous architecture to make it look at home in its rural setting and to conform to the easy, generous, yet unpretentious way of living that our clients envision. The landscaping is cultivated in the immediate vicinity of the house, but natural beyond. All right, go ahead and move to slide 14, where you're going to continue to take notes. Slide 14 is titled American Vernacular. So the new Castle County house was built for a family of three, which I just described, and it's designed to sit comfortably in nature. Notice I don't say unify with nature or exist in harmony with nature. It's just supposed to be something that comfortably sits within its natural setting. It neither crowns a hilltop, it doesn't hover near a well-trimmed lawn, it doesn't exist above a waterfall. It basically sits surrounded by rolling fields next to a thickly wooded forest. And just like slide 13 talked about, Robert Venturi did think about and intend to reference American farmhouses and barns. So one area of reference for that is he painted parts of the house white, because that's something that you would see on a lot of American barns, this white painted siding. Another thing you see with barns are intersecting gables clad with wood shingles. And so the house in Newcastle County may look familiar and conventional, but the exterior is enlivened by a diverse array of mischievous and very perplexing architectural features. So, of particular interest is how Venturi treated the front and the rear facades. And one of your pictures is a side view of the front facade. And so, in one of his books, he writes about celebrating the concept of a decorated shed. Buildings that exploit easily recognizable two-dimensional elements and generate visual interest and meaning. So this makes me think of this billboard idea that we discussed earlier, where like you look at the front of the house and it's kind of like an ad or a statement for what you're going to find within. So the front facade has this floating arched screen, which from the front might seem attached from the house, but it almost kind of looks like a stage prop when you look at it from the side. And basically, it's something that is right in front of the gable of the house. And Venturi claimed that this curved feature had Baroque origins. And he also claimed that it functioned as a sign, meaning that it was supposed to signify that this is a house. And furthermore, the owners enjoyed bird watching, and so it might have also doubled as somewhat of a blind, like blocking the windows that are behind it, so that if they were bird watching, their movement in the windows wouldn't scare away the birds. Now, the rear facade is even more complex and more, I find, a little puzzling. So it too features a prominent arch screen. This screen is framed by the edges of the gabled roof. And the gabled roof is just that triangular part that you see, and we still see in a lot of houses. A gable and a pediment are similar. So essentially, pediment we use when we talk about like churches and ancient architecture. And a gable is where we would describe that same triangular feature if it was used for a home. So looking at this, we see what appears to be a Doric colonnade, kind of like these short, fat Doric columns. And I'll label these on the slide. You're still on slide 14. And they are, in fact, just kind of like a veneer. They're two-dimensional. They're thin, just like the outer walls, and they are essentially cutouts. They carry little weight, but they do enclose the recessed porch. While the column on the right grows seamlessly out of the adjoining wall, you can see the column that's the furthest right. We kind of just see half of it. We see that the column all the way to the left is split in half by an aluminum drain pipe. So we have this classical reference, but it's almost like cartoonish. And it's somewhat awkward. It's not symmetrical. We're not having conversations about balance and proportion. But overall, what it does achieve is it does create this whimsical appearance. Go ahead and move to slide 15, Playfully Challenging. Now we're going to take a look at this very interesting interior, which you already previewed in slide 13. So in photographs dating from the time of the building's completion, the spacious interiors appear simple and comfortable. There's wood decoration that is inspired by a variety of 19th century design traditions. There's painted arches in the vaulted music room, which you can see have like a turquoise color with kind of a, how do I describe this color? Like a kind of a flat gold and white zigzag type shape across those arches. The painted arches, there's a quirky chandelier It looks just very flat, very craft-like, very crafty, I almost want to say. It looks like it was hand-cut. And then there's also just a lot of two-dimensional, fanciful silhouettes that essentially kind of reference a variety of 19th century styles. Now, kind of, if you're looking at all these elements, it's basically everything kind of like attached to the ceiling and that far wall. So Venturi never liked the stylistic term postmodern, but his buildings and his critical writings really helped propel late 20th century architecture in a new direction. And the way that it moves into a new direction is he's challenging the simplicity, the minimalism, the reductive quality of modern architecture. And buildings like this private residence remain to be a playfully challenging work that essentially the most important takeaway is that it expresses a refreshingly pluralistic view of architecture and design in the 20th century.